Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Red and Buried podcast. I'm Frankie, and I'm delighted to be joined today by the wonderful J.M. Hall.
Well, I can't clap myself. That sounds a little bit...
You can clap yourself.
Okay. That's it.
You deserve it. You deserve all the rounds of applause. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining me today. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really... happy. I'm just getting used to not being a full-time teacher. So I've still got that lovely thing of waking up and thinking, I do go into school and it's a very important part of my life. But I'm just getting used to being the life of a writer, which is very different, the full-time as opposed to...
I bet. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Has your body clock adjusted to the change yet?
No. I'm either, and this is since November. So I'm either waking up in the small hours, unable to sleep, or I'm sleeping through till 8 o'clock, which is a lie-in of huge proportions for me.
Yeah.
But I do feel, since I've recognised, you know what, this is an adjustment, this is going to take time, then it's been a little easier. So I just thought, just straight from full-time teaching to full-time writing, it'll be a cinch. And well, it wasn't.
Takes a bit of time, but I'm sure you'll get the hang of it. I'm sure you'll settle in nicely to the writing
it's,
life.
It's a lovely problem to have. So I'm really not complaining at all.
Well, I've got a little bio about you, which I'll quickly read out, which actually I was going to say about you just retiring, so we could talk about that more in a minute. And then I've taken it from various internet sources. Hopefully it's all accurate, but please feel free to tell me if I've got anything horribly wrong. Yes, get your red pen out from your teaching days and you can tell me.
Green pen. We're marking.
Oh, okay. Is that more positive than red?
Confrontational, a bit corrective. So as long as I can remember, I've been marking in green pen. Anyway.
That's very nice.
There we are.
I like that. Okay. Green pens at the ready. Here we go. So J.M. Jonathan Hall lives in Yorkshire where, and this is your line, by the way, after many more years than he'd care to remember, he's just retired from being deputy head of a primary school. His plays have been produced in theatres across the UK as well as for radio, the most recent being the BBC Radio 4 series Trust, starring Julie... Oh, God, I should have asked checked for the pronunciation.
Hesman.
Thank you. Bless you. Thank you.
We're putting the wonderful Julie Hesman house.
The wonderful. Okay, that is important.
She could read a shopping list and make it sound like Shakespeare, seriously.
Well, I'm sure it helps when the words are good as well, such as in the play that you've written. The fourth series of which has just aired with a fifth currently in production. Is that still correct?
It is. And, I don't know. I want to add a little bit to it. Am I going to?
No.
I am. It's the fourth series. And look, I'm sorry. It has just won the audio award for the best drama series, BBC Audio Awards. To my... But that was such a team effort. It was Julie, it was Gary, the director, it was the wonderful cast of Susan, Jonathan, Ashley. So it's not me saying, I won an award. It was just lovely being part of a very, very strong team. And I think that makes a difference when you write, whether you've got a strong editor, a strong director, someone to dramaturge you. It really, really does help. Yeah.
Of course, but you have just won an award, so congratulations to you.
All right, I've won an award.
But you're writing.
A big floating balloon saying congratulations. So
amazing. Well, very well deserved. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So in 2021, A Spoonful of Murder, his first novel, introduced us to his unlikely crime-solving trio, Liz, Thelma and Pat, and became an international bestseller. These wonderfully warm and funny characters took on a life of their own and have spawned a series of cozy crime novels, including, as you said, A Spoonful of Murder. And more recently, A Pen Dipped in Poison. And more, his new book, people can't see.
I'm sorry, I thought pointing. It was going to be broadcast live, and everyone I've seen, they've all had their books behind them, but I can move this in a moment. But
it's a stunning display. I'm very happy to see it. So, but his latest book is A Clock Stopped Dead.
It is.
Good. Retired teachers Pat, Liz and Thelma are happiest whiling away their hours over coffee, cake and chat at the Thirsk Garden Centre Cafe. But when their good friend tells them about an unsettling experience she had in a sinister-feeling charity shop, they simply can't resist investigating, because the entire shop has vanished into thin air.
There we go.
Dun, dun, dun.
Absolutely.
Before long, our trio of unlikely sleuths find themselves embroiled in a race against the clock to get to the bottom of this mystery. But who has a secret to hide, and how far will they go to keep it concealed? Only time will tell. Dun, dun, dun.
Thank you.
Outside of writing, Jonathan enjoys coffee, theatre and travel. As well as being a very talented writer across multiple mediums, he is very kind, generous with his time and supportive of artists of all disciplines. Is that true?
I'm part of a group called Script Yorkshire, because for years I was a playwright, an unperformed playwright, so I know all about what it's like to send your play off to somewhere and never hear anything back. And there were a few of us who felt like there are many, many, many more talented writers and there are opportunities for them, particularly with theatre, because if you're writing theatre, you need actors, theatre, a director, whereas if you write a book, you know, it's a bit more simple. I'm part of an organisation and we're there to try and give a bit of a chance to writers by giving them competitions, radio writing opportunities, script in hand stagings, workshops, whatever. And we've built up a bit of a community of writers here in West Yorkshire. We do sort of pub theatre nights, we do scratch nights, we do
writing moments.
So it is all about, and honestly, writing is, I mean, I don't know. Do you write yourself, Frankie? This is me asking. I should have found this out myself.
No. I have not. I'm not published or anything like that. No.
Well, then, but you probably know from the many people you've talked to, writing is such a lonely, introspective thing that anything you can do that takes you away from the desk and puts you into the world with other people, you know, is a good thing, and it charges your batteries up. So I get as much from it, I have to say, all the things I do.
Well, that's wonderful. And as you say, now that you're doing it full time as well, I imagine you'll value those kind of collegial kind of relationships and friendships to help you stay on it.
Absolutely. You can get so lost in the day when you're just writing. Mm. And also my day at school, I do one day a week at school and I teach creative writing and I work with kids writing. And that is massively important to me, still to be in that sort of environment, in that structure, but not to have any of the sort of pressures of being the deputy head, just to come in, teach writing. And then Wednesday night, it's like, right, the weekend starts here and I'm off. So I love it.
Fantastic. How old are the children you teach?
Primary school. I work with year six, but I work with year one, year two. I love going into the nursery and telling stories. It's where I've always worked in primary school. And it's my happy place.
That's amazing. I imagine the amount of children that you've inspired to write and try writing must be incredibly rewarding.
I do get messages from these grown-up people who say, you taught me. And it is lovely, but you think, hang on, aren't you six? What are you doing?
Their writing's clearly very good.
Instagram account, living in Australia, running a travel firm, etc. But yeah, it is. It's great. It's sort of like, it's your place on the planet, really. That kind of immortality, almost, in a word. Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. And clearly writing has always been a huge part of your life.
Right from being at primary school. Yeah, always.
Did you have a teacher that inspired you with your writing?
Yes, I did. Mrs. Sandra Appleton of Rushcliffe Secondary School, who still proofreads my novels now.
No.
I send them to her. She was the one who took my writing seriously. She was the one who gave me exercise books to write in and would read all my stuff. She got me writing short stories. And when I wrote plays that were on, she came to see them. And I've stayed in touch all these years. And more than that, the writing that she exposed me and my peers to To Kill a Mockingbird, T.S. Eliot, Chaucer, Shakespeare, this great Betjeman, Ted Hughes, a real foundation. Because I do think as a writer, you do need to read personally. It's sort of like, not because by reading you learn things, but you just see the way people say things in different ways and the different ways people do things. And you think, oh, you know, that is something I could write. I couldn't write it like that, but I could do it like that. So, yeah. So big shout out to Sandra Appleton of Rushcliffe School, West Bridgeford, Nottingham.
That's the loveliest thing I think I've ever heard. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. That's so lovely that you keep in touch and that she's still teaching you after all these years, really.
Yeah, yeah. She's the comment. The comments don't get any less painful. I don't like the way you do this. I send her a red pen. When I send her a typescript, I put a red pen in with it and back it.
Oh, you should send a green one.
I should. I should say, right?
You deserve a green pen.
We've been doing this for 50 years. The time has come for a change. Let's go from red to green. It'll be kinder on me.
That might soften the blow a little bit, yeah. Right. I was just thinking, as a teacher of children of so many ages and, you know, as a full-time writer now, you must have the thickest skin when it comes to criticism of your work of all time.
No. No, I daren't read reviews because on my bad days, I would be my worst review. When I was writing for theatre and my first play was on, well, really, my only play was on. I read every review, and it has the power to echo and confirm those doubts you have in your head. When somebody says something nice, there is always part of you that thinks, oh, you're just being kind, you know, you're just being all right, you know. And if somebody says something, but no, I don't read reviews, and that is pure cowardice. Pure cowardice.
Not at all.
It's really. It sounds. I would become that person. So no,
but not reviews. So maybe not reviews, but obviously you welcome feedback and as a part of your learning.
Oh,
through.
Yeah. Now that is absolutely right. And what I learned, particularly with the radio scripts, because I've written. I've written 14 now.
Wow. And it's amazing.
I'm just having a bit of an out-of-body moment here. And I'm going, what? But Gary Brown, the director, who's done loads of stuff, worked with loads of people, like Glenda Jackson and so.
Wow.
He is a really gifted dramaturge, and he can make my writing better. So I learn when I see what he says to think, right, okay, this is what I need. And I think as a writer, you have to have those people, you have to have that feedback. My editors at HarperCollins, I've had some really good editors, Cara and Molly and now Sarah. So yes, but it's their job to make the script, the story, the best it can be. So I listen to those, but I suppose it's more like to give feedback is a real skill. And I don't know, people come up to you and they go, shall I be honest? And you think, no, lie.
Absolutely not.
Lie. Yes, feedback's important, but.
Solicited feedback is important.
From trusted people.
Yes. Absolutely. That's fair enough.
Okay.
I think that makes complete sense.
Well, yes, because I think I'm too old to change and start reading. I mean, I've been to these things where, you know, when years ago I was writing for the BBC, and you get a load of feedback on the script and you change it and it goes to someone else and you change it and you go to someone else and you change it. And then after about six lots of changes, it went to someone who wanted it all to be as it was in the first place. So, yeah, you know, you do have to learn to trust your own judgment a bit as well.
Yeah. No, I imagine you have to be in the entertainment world in general and write for that, you have to have a degree of confidence and even to get published, really, to put yourself out there.
Yeah. There has to be a certain part of you that thinks, right, I'm swinging it.
Yeah.
I'm going into this. Yeah, definitely.
And something obviously happened for you to take the move into writing books after writing plays for so long.
Oh, there's a story here.
I'm ready. Tell me everything. So ready.
Okay. Well, yeah, for years I'd written fringe theatre in London and had plays on in Edinburgh and what have you. Had a few radio plays on. I never thought I'd write a novel. Or rather, I never thought I'd write a crime novel. Now, don't get me wrong, I love crime novels. I love the crime novels, particularly where there's, like, you know, some grimy northern place with a load of dismembered bodies turning up and what have you.
Yep.
And I'm making it sound like I'm poking fun at them. I absolutely am not. One of the lovely things about the job is I get sent a load of crime novels to read. I'm reading the new one by Janice Hallett, The Examiner. Big shout out. It's brilliant. It really, really is a page turner, and I'm really intrigued and whatever. I never thought it was for me. And then my mother died in 2014, and we became aware that my father was developing memory problems. He started saying, well, you know, it's a very common story. It was sort of like, you know, well, I think your mother's there somewhere or whatever. And it was like, right, okay, this is where we're going. And then he was frauded. Somebody rang him up and said, you need to transfer all your money out of your account. And he did. Eye-wateringly large sum. But the thing was, Dad used to be a bank manager. And it was a sign to us of how ill he was that he did this. But the shocking thing was not that it happened, that somebody who we will never know did this, but it was the bank, the attitude of the bank, which was just at the time when Fred Goodwin had nearly driven the thing into oblivion anyway. And it was sort of denial, corporate denial stroke indifference. Not answering your problem, your questions. We were going into this really thoroughly, saying, Dad came in and he said this. How did this happen? What? And it was just stonewalling. And that was the shocking thing, that the bank that my dad had worked for since he was 17, that he played for the cricket team right throughout my teens. He hired their narrowboats. I mean, the bank was this big, cozy part of our life. And then suddenly you saw it was very cold and very corporate, and very irresponsible, and yes, to an extent, dishonest. That was the shocking thing. And I spent a year writing to the bank, to the ombudsman, to the MP, to solicitors, to Gloria Hunniford's Consumer Awareness Programme, you name it. And there was nothing. And my sister said, you should write about this. And I thought, this is not a fringe play. This is not best will in the world. And so I remember I was sitting in York Station and I just started writing the opening words of A Spoonful of Murder. So what A Spoonful of Murder was me dealing with what had happened to Dad. And it wasn't just the fraud. Suddenly we became aware how vulnerable older people are and what a target they are, like the junk mail he kept receiving and responding to, like the procession of people wanting to fit solar panels. And then my boss's widowed mother was suddenly approached by somebody who said, oh, your late husband contacted us to fit the roof. And they find these people, like, they go through the obituaries. So really, it was a big shout of anger, but me being me, ended up as a sort of cozy crime novel. So it's a shout of anger with tea and sponge cake.
but you're empowering. Your characters are empowered. They're intelligent and they are not fools.
That was me. That was me. Yeah. Do you know what? The universe is right after all, because there are these people in it. And so that was how the novel came. And I suddenly realized I'd got these three women who were me to an extent. And it was like, as they were navigating their way into their 60s, I was thinking, oh, well, you know, I could do this again. I like this. I like these women. I like this place. I like writing about thirst. But the only thing is, no, not the only thing, that none of them have police procedure. You'll understand this. You know Miss Marple and all her... There's a very famous one where she says, you know, there's this really interesting one. She said, Mrs. So-and-so went to the shop and her string bag had been cut and her gill of pickled shrimps had disappeared. That's the sort of premise of her novels. So really, mine are all about these things that happen, and they sit down and they say, what's this about? What's happening here? But no, I keep them all away from police procedure because I love reading police procedure. I love watching Vera and things like that, but that's not what I could write. So sorry, I told you it was a long answer. There we go.
No, it's a great answer. I mean, it's a hell of a story. And I'm so sorry that it was such a tragic way to find this amazing career, but I guess some good has come from it.
The worst things, good does come out of it, you know, in some ways. And it has been good. And it does feel like I've sort of honoured mum and dad's memory through this.
Of course. Yeah. No, I mean, and what an amazing way to honour them. And I'm sure they'd be incredibly proud of that. So your characters, Pat, Liz and Thelma, are amazing. They're everyone's best friends. Everyone loves them. You know, I know you don't read reviews, but that's what everybody says in them is how much they love
that's
them.
That's good.
So they're all a bit of you. But a question I always ask every author I speak to is, if you had to be a character from one of your books, who would you be?
Yeah, I was thinking that because I read those questions you sent.
Yeah.
It would have to be Pat because she's got an amazing kitchen.
Yes.
Which is not like my kitchen, I have to say, as I sort of tried to declutter a bit this afternoon. And she is married to a builder. I thought, you know, and I just think, oh, yeah. So you'd say, oh, my God, this is coming off. And you go, oh, it's all right. I'll fix it. So, yeah, I think it would be Pat, though. I would love to have Thelma's wisdom and faith and certain. But also Liz, I think, is probably mostly me, the way she panics about parking places and what people are going to say and what have you. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Pat for her kitchen. Sorry, girls, but
I'm sure they'd understand.
Sure
it's a pretty good kitchen.
Yeah.
So, okay. So do you think that in order to write character, you have to put a bit of yourself into that character?
Yes. And there's an answer, because otherwise you're writing caricatures. What do I mean by that?
Mm.
I mean, with all the characters I write, I have to put something in that is like, oh, yeah. You have to understand why they do what they do.
Yes.
You understand that. You have to sort of be and think, okay. I think the challenge with a crime novel is you have to understand why someone would do whatever it is they do. You know, you might not agree with that, but you have to be able to do that to make it believable. The thing about Agatha Christie, why I think she is the icon that she is, it's no accident, is that all the people who commit the crimes in the novels, there is a real tragic reality about why they've done what they've done. And I don't think there's any of her villains, for want of a better word, you think, well, I don't like you. You can, I suppose there's somewhere Miss Marple says, well, it's a good thing he's going to hang, you know. think about Death on the Nile or Murder on the Orient Express, you are rooting for these people, some part of you.
There's humanity to the villains.
That's right. There's humanity to the, and to have humanity, you have to. You know, and even if it's just a very small character. I know a lot of really talented actors, and again, who there's more chances for less more actors than there are chances for them. And even if they're just in the bar of the wool pack, or you know, they have to put their life and soul into that moment for it to be real and it to work.
Yeah.
So
no, absolutely. Do you, obviously, from a playwriting background and now writing these books, do you think that maybe we'll ever see an adaptation of your lovely characters?
People ask that. People do ask that. And I was at a Script Yorkshire television workshop. Wonderful writer, Lisa Holdsworth, brilliant TV writer, great person. And she was talking about the whole process of writing TV, and you can sort of see the kind of the way that the things become corporatized and changed and what have you. And I was always the one thinking, well, I don't know. Do I want to see that change? Because I have to find this like a really brilliant book, and it's turned into a 2-hour TV special, and you think more must be lost. Yeah. But having said that, you know, never say, well, I wouldn't say never. If somebody came along and wanted to do them, yes, of course I would. Though I think rather than the novels, I've done a number of short stories about Pat, Liz and Thelma. I think they would adapt better for TV simply because of the length of them, you know.
What about radio plays?
Radio plays. Yeah, again, the same thing about length. I could see the short stories.
Yeah.
I suppose there'd be a problem, which I never thought about when I started writing, is you've got three women of a similar age. So you're going to have three similar voices.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I started, a lot of things, some of the feedback I did get was I had to keep going back and seeing who was who. And I thought, well, yeah, because you've got three, you've got Pat and Liz, fairly similar names, Thelma a bit different. And you think, yeah, actually. But if you're writing about primary school teachers, you know, I've worked with and Liz and Sue and Sarah and, you know, names from a certain bracket. But yeah, maybe radio. Who knows? I love writing for radio, so that would be great. Yes.
Well, maybe something to think about.
Oh, yeah, and it would be such a dream if Julie Esmond Hulsh would, because she reads the audiobooks.
Yes, yeah, and yeah. Well, she's halfway there.
Exactly. It'd be such a dream if she was one of the characters.
Well, that's our pitch to her now. That's out there.
Julie,
if you're listening.
Help me bring it.
I'm sorry I couldn't pronounce your surname, but if you could.
I think you could do that. She's one of the warmest, nicest actors, professionals you could meet, seriously. Because, you know, you meet some people and they're not quite like you think they're going to be. Well, she.
Yeah. So. Oh, that's amazing. And I'm really curious as well, as somebody that's written across multiple disciplines the way you have, your writing process must be very interesting. Do you find it dramatically different writing your scripts versus writing your books?
Yeah. A book is a marathon. A radio script is more of a sprint. Once I plan out a radio script, when I start writing, I write longhand. I think it's the primary school teacher in me, but there's something about filling up a book, which I find very good for the soul. But
so you physically write out the entire book?
I write it out.
Pen and paper.
And then I type up a chapter. So I write it.
Wow.
I'm just trying to think. I had one. Oh, yeah, here we go. The works. Sorry, I bet you're not allowed to do product placement, but the works do amazing books. I get all my rights. So, yeah, that's.
Wow.
And then I will type it up, because there's something about the writing longhand that gives me time and space, and I can go back over it. I find the initial writing process is more akin to sketching, because you're writing a little bit that works in a little bit, and you're looking, you're joining them up and whatever. Going straight onto a screen would be to start working at a stage I wasn't yet at, if that makes sense. Because to write a sentence, there has to be a certain level that the story is at, and it starts off before that for me. My ideas don't come sort of fully formed in sentences left to right going down the screen. But when I write a radio play, I mean, I can do in like a day.
Yeah.
Then, of course, I type it up and then I go through it and then I go through it. But with a novel, it's going to be a chapter a day. Type it up, write it rough, type it up, read it through. And in a good time when it's going really well, you can maybe do a chapter a day. So, you know, you are looking at a really long process. And with a radio play, you've got 50 pages of double-spaced speech to go through. Whereas with a book, you've got, you know, you've got 320 pages of prose to go through. So they are different. I don't think there's any hurrying for me writing a novel. I do see people saying, oh, well, I've got a word count of however many words a day and what have you.
Yeah.
I don't do it like that. Maybe I should.
Okay. Well, no, I mean, whatever works for you, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, sorry, I'm a tiny bit distracted because a tiny spider has just run onto my desk.
Oh, goodness me. Now, it's not a little spider because that's good. I don't know.
I don't think it was money.
Many spiders, good luck. How can a spider be good luck?
I know, I guess they're eating flies, but I don't know what that stops with money. But I don't know where it's gone. I'm assuming it's fine.
That's okay. Well, look, if it comes, we'll just have a little spider moment, you know.
Thank you. I appreciate
okay,
it.
That's fine.
It was fine before when it was up there, but now it was like running at me. So I was like, oh, it's out for an attack now, but it's gone somewhere. Okay. So I don't know. That's fine. Cool. But anyway, okay. So I'm really curious then, what do you enjoy most and least about the writing process then?
When it goes well, it's my superpower. I'm no good at sport, DIY. I'm an okay cook as long as you like the same meals.
And you have Pat's Kitchen.
Pat's Kitchen. Gosh, yes, I probably like different things if I wasn't like, our kitchen's really tiny. So when I've got an idea and I'm writing it down, there is no better feeling in the world because you just feel this is it. You feel sort of engaged with yourself and the world and whatever. That's what I like most. And conversely, what I like least is when it doesn't go well.
And, that's interesting.
And there is this feeling that you're as good as the last word you've written. And if you finish off the day on a muddled, inconclusive note, that's when you go, I can't do this anymore. I can't, you know, I say to my husband, I can't write anymore. And, you know, fortunately, this is ignored. So, yes, it's such a subjective thing. When it goes well, it's amazing. And when it doesn't go well, and also the other thing, when it doesn't go well, it sort of saps the energy. When I was working full-time teaching, well, I was on 3 days a week. I think, well, do you know what? In those days when I'm writing, when I stop, what I'm going to do is I'll write in the morning and in the afternoon I'm going to tidy out a cupboard or I'm going to do this or go for a walk or whatever. And when it's not gone well, it saps your energy for everything, I find.
Mm.
So, you know, you might force yourself to go and chop some carrots or whatever, but you're not sort of like, right, okay, I'm going to do. And I think if there's one thing I need to learn, it's when to stop. It's to stop before you stop, if that makes sense. When you feel like, you know, you're playing freestyle more than you're actually writing, that's the time to think, right, I have to leave it for today. It's gone. And you're always frightened, though, that it'll never come back. And that fear never goes away. And every morning when I sit down to write, there's this, can I do it today feeling? Just that moment. So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you've been able to overcome it to write these three wonderful books.
Thank you.
And obviously, this is the third now in your series.
Yeah.
Will there be more?
There is a fourth.
Fantastic.
Which is just gone. The first draft went off a couple of weeks ago. So I'm waiting for the next stage of work for that. I'm only contracted to write four, but you do then start thinking, and I have got an idea for a fifth and a sixth.
Ooh.
Because of the first one, the ideas I have to be, for me, really sort of strong. And it's almost like I have to be kind of angry about something. And you know, like Agatha Christie, in each of her novels, every novel, there was you could tell there was an idea that really fired her up. Like, yeah. Five Little Pigs, which I think is one of the best crime novels ever written.
Yeah.
There is a real fire at the heart of it. And it's like, yes. If I catch myself thinking, oh, well, you know, someone could eat a poisoned fairy cake. And then you think, no. Stop already. Yeah. Stop already. So, yeah. I would like to write. But I also want to write other novels, I've decided.
Fantastic.
I would like to write, like, an LGBT one.
Brilliant.
One of my age, because all the LGBT novels, which are great, and don't get me wrong, and I love Heartstopper and Red, Right, and Blue and everything. But they are all about very young people with all their lives in front of them. Now, there's a wonderful writer called Matt Cain, and he wrote a story called The Love Song of Albert Entwistle, and I've just got his new one. But there's not so many. I want to write Heartstopper with defibrillators.
I love that.
Well, it's we'll see. And it's just interesting to try and write something different. And do something.
Yeah.
And I'm writing a fifth series of Trust, which is lovely, but I'm also putting in other radio ideas. So.
Oh, you're busy.
Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. I've been standing at this bus stop 30 years. Who would come at once? So, yeah.
Always the way, isn't it? I'm
not taking this for granted. But yeah, because I think when you write, you do. Because I mean, I guess, going back to Agatha, sorry, but.
Always back to Agatha. I'm happy to be there.
But the Mary Westmacott novels, which are great and not really known about, I don't think, even though, you know, Giant's Bread and A Daughter's a Daughter and Absent in Spring, I think, is one of the best novels, you know. So, yes, I'm writing. I've got the life of a writer ahead of me as long as I have.
Fantastic. I love that. And definitely please go and write all of those things. So, but to bring it back to A Clock Stop Dead, what are you angry about there? Charity shops? Have they done something to you?
No, it's not charity shops. I did want to write something with a bit more of a supernatural feel to it.
Yes.
So we have got this woman on a foggy night and she's stranded. She goes into a charity shop. A voice comes out of the darkness saying, "Why did you do it?" She panics and she runs. And then she goes back the next day.
It's
shop's gone. No shop. And so I was generally angry at that. Sorry, I sound like a right old grouch.
I love it.
Well, yeah, I was writing it. There's a lot in it about winter fuel bills and warm places and poverty and how some people are struggling massively, whereas other people are.
Yeah.
But it's less of it's less than it is. I mean, Appendix in Poison is me being angry about the academy system in schools. And in the fourth one, somebody's found dead, and it turns out they're an Ofsted inspector.
Oh, okay. Bit cathartic, no, I imagine, writing that one.
I don't know whether this will stay. I don't know whether this will have to be edited out or whatever. So, A Clock Stop Dead, I suppose, the four of them is perhaps the least angry. Sorry to disappoint people.
No, I think that's fine. It's nice to not be always angry all the time, but I think there's still plenty in there of anger.
Well, there's a lot
going.
You know, there was that winter and our fuel bills just went through the roof, and you know, we were opening up our church for people to go and sit in to stay warm. And you think it's 2024. You know, there's more food banks than there are actual banks.
Yeah. Feel free to make a future victim a Tory MP or something. I don't know. Just brainstorming.
There is an idea. Yeah. But
brainstorming.
I think we'll have had an election before then, but we'll see. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Oh, fantastic. And another question I like to ask. I mean, you've already touched upon a few books that you've read lately that you've loved, but what was the last book that you read and loved?
That I read and loved? It was one that my nephew and his partner, Jess, gave me for Christmas, but I got the other week. And it was called Wranglestone, and it was a teen novel. And now the whole zombie oeuvre freaks me out, because when I was 16, 17, I went to the cinema to see my first ever X film, which was Zombies Dawn of the Dead by George A. Romero. I still have nightmares about that. And I keep all the way away from anything like The Walking Dead, 28 Days Later, or whatever. I know they are brilliant things, but they just scare me too much.
Yeah.
This story has the premise that there has been a zombie apocalypse, and the remnants, one lot of remnants of survivors, have gone to this lake somewhere in Canada and North America, and they've gone onto the islands where they're safe. But they fear the coming of the winter, because with the winter, the lakes freeze over.
And they can walk
the
over the lakes.
Can walk over the ice. And it's an LGBT love story. It had me really on the edge of my seat. I was uncomfortable reading it in places because of the situations they were getting into, but it was really good. Yeah.
Wow.
So
you read very broadly then.
Well, normally I don't. I do get sent a lot of cozy crime novels. It's my privilege to get sent cozy crime novels to read.
Yeah.
Give, you know, feedback and comment on. As I say, I've just read The Examiner. I've got one by a writer called Jamie West called Murder at the Matinee, which I'm really looking forward to. He wrote one called, it's set in the 1930s theatre, so I'm really looking forward to that. But sometimes it's just a blissful change to go on to something different, you know?
Yeah.
And read something that you wouldn't normally read. Reading is it's a commitment, you know, to say you read someone's book and give feedback. So it does tend to take most of your reading attention. But Wranglestone, maybe it was different, maybe because I didn't want to read it because of the subject or whatever, and it surprised me and got me really emotional and wanting to read the next one. So, yeah.
Wow. That's the sign of a very good book then.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And also when someone gifts you a book that you may not have picked yourself, that can be quite exciting sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, sometimes you sort of feel a bit like, you know, what if I don't like it?
Yeah, awkward.
Or whatever. You do feel it. And the fact is, I've got far more books to read than I ever could. I mean, there is literally a pile 3 feet high by my bed of different books I've read or what have you. So, yeah, so when you actually get through one, when you actually finish one, because you can get stuck in the middle of one, not because of the book, because of where you are at that time with your writing or whatever. And when you're in the throes of a story, to read someone else's story is really difficult. So
I have a number of the authors I've spoken to have said the same thing, like some can't read other fiction while they're writing in case... You know, not only does it disrupt their story in their mind, but also they're so worried about stealing bits by mistake or without realizing, or, you know, taking ideas. So,
yeah,
it can be tricky.
I'm thinking about that. I suppose I've usually got the story quite strong in my mind. So, no.
Yeah.
And usually books I read are very different. I mean, cozy crime is a genre, but it's such a broad church, you know. I mean,
oh yeah,
that no. I mean, if someone was to give me a story about three retired primary school teachers, I might be a bit like, oh, I better not read. Not yet. I was going to write, you know.
Yeah, maybe instruct a lawyer at that point as well.
No, definitely not.
Cheeky. Oh, well, that's great. And speaking of writing, one other question I want to ask you about your writing process before we move on is a new question I've started asking people is, what's a line that you've written lately or from your back catalogue that you're especially proud of?
Yes. Well, and I was thinking about this today. And I think it would be from Appendix. I'm going to go all Jack and Ori on you now.
I love it. Okay. I'm sitting comfortably.
Well, it's about, it is about, so there's Liz Pat and Thelma. This is book two. I'm not giving any spoilers, but Pat has been a bit worried and feeling the march of time because her husband has just been through treatment and recovered for cancer. And so she is sort of saying to her friends, you know, this is it, I'm getting older, I'm worried. And her friends say, they don't say anything because really there isn't anything to say. And being friends as they were, it wasn't about dismissing or belittling or even trying to resolve those thoughts, but about sitting alongside and putting them into realistic everyday context with chat about families and gardening, shared memories, and of course, the intriguing behaviour of those around them. And now sitting there in Gloucester Services, northbound, Pat realised something of that. And she also realised both Thelma and Liz knew and would sit alongside her for as long and as often as was necessary.
That's a lovely line.
Thank you.
Great choice. Yeah.
Aww. So I have a few lines like that in the books, and you read them and you really feel like you've hit a note here for you. Maybe for you. So yeah.
Oh, that's a good writing day.
That was a good moment. That those things they sing out. You know, it's the other ones that you but there you go. That's right.
They make it all worth it, though.
Yeah, those moments. They're those little beacons that you get to.
Yeah. Oh, Jonathan, I'm having such a wonderful time chatting to you.
Oh, really?
You're
glad.
An utter delight. Really, it's such a lovely conversation, but now it's such a shame that I have to now confront you about something terrible that you've done.
Okay.
I know. Plot twist, tone shift, because unfortunately, J.M. Hall, you have committed a crime, haven't you?
Have I?
So you have.
Okay.
Well, so terrible, so shocking and heinous in nature was this crime, J.M. Hall, that you have been sentenced to death for it.
Yeah. Well, it was a long time coming.
Was it now? That's interesting. What terrible crime have you committed then?
Could I possibly have committed?
You seem so nice.
I don't know.
What could you possibly have done?
Panicking about the other day. Putting some bric-a-brac into the charity shop bag instead of just clothes and burying it at the bottom under my pullovers.
I'm sorry, but sentence I think you deserve death. The death penalty for that.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
No, I'm absolutely outrageous crime. Probably the most shocking we've seen on this podcast.
There we go.
Very unbelievable. Well, the good news is, despite how heinous that particular crime was that you have shamelessly confessed to, I can get you the death row meal of your dreams.
Okay.
So it's not all bad.
Okay. Well, it would be the last meal I had before leaving this life. I don't know. My instinct would be to play it down and not go out of this life with indigestion. So I just ask for a great big bowl of porridge and fruit. And yeah, do you know what? I say, well, I won't have honey because of the sugar levels, but so what? I'll have honey on it. And
I'll have
creme fraiche on it as well.
Oh, wow. Well, you know what?
Cholesterol or sugar. So there we go.
We've never had anyone pick porridge before. That's a first.
Well, I was thinking about this, you know, because I don't know, final meals, whatever. I remember my darling mum in the hospice and she had a big plate of scrambled eggs. And I would say she enjoyed that as much as she'd enjoyed anything those past few months.
That's wonderful. Well, I mean, if it's a comfort meal, then all the better for it.
Yes, you're right. It's not so much the taste, but the security it represents.
Yeah.
Familiarity, whatever. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Okay. And just real quick, what fruit are you having on this porridge?
I am having blueberries because I like blueberries.
Good.
Yeah.
And they're great choice.
To health, you know.
Yeah, antioxidants. I mean, at that point, that's the least of your worries, but sure.
I know. But I was, I don't want to go, because someone would have to do an autopsy and I'd want it to be as, good for them as possible.
You're very thoughtful. That's very kind. It's a shame that, you committed that crime. Mm. And would you have a coffee with it or anything?
No, I would have a cup of Yorkshire tea, strong Yorkshire tea, no sugar.
Yorkshire to the end. Yorkshire, I love that. Perfect. Well, unfortunately, I'm so sorry to tell you that you are now dead. But don't worry, very quick and painless and very smooth. But more good news is probably the wrong word for it. But more news is I will bury you with the book of your choice.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I did meet somebody once who swore that Emily Bronte had been buried with the manuscript of her second novel and he wanted to have her exhumed.
Oh, wow.
I was thinking, okay, if I'm going to be buried with a book, do you know what? It'd have to be the Bible because, that would be, I wouldn't be reading. It would be what it represented more than whatever.
Yeah.
But my favorite, my books I loved and whatever, I would gift to other people before I went.
Oh, that's very nice. Just make sure you put it in the right bag at the shop because otherwise you're a serial serial offender. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Oh, Jonathan, I've had truly such a wonderful time chatting to you. Thank you so much for spending this time
with me. Thank you so much, Frankie. I just had a really good chatter, really good natter. It's been very good. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, I feel like we've done Pat, Liz and Thelma proud with our chatting. We just needed some cake, didn't we, really?
Yeah,
this would have been perfect.
It's only really Pat. Well, in the fourth book, here's a spoiler. Liz realises she has to cut down on her sugar levels. Hello.
No!
So there's a lot of gazing at the various cakes.
Longingly.
Feral.
I'd be the same way, I understand.
Yeah.
Oh, and so is The Clock Stop Dead is out now, isn't it?
It's coming out next week on the 11th.
Next week?
The 11th of April. I looked today, I had a sudden panic because, suddenly you think, oh gosh, people are actually going to read it then. And you're like,
yeah.
So, Clock Stop Dead on the 11th.
Fantastic. And where can people follow you online?
I'm not very good on Instagram. Now, I am going off Facebook. I do feel I should put this on Facebook because it's probably going to be the only time I ever have this. My editor said this would make a marvellous murder weapon.
Oh, it would. Anyway,
it is huge.
Weighty.
But I'm on Instagram as JM Hall Writer. That's where I can be followed.
Fantastic.
I love it when people follow and like and what have you. So, yes.
Yes, no, absolutely. Everyone go and follow Jonathan and go buy the books, all three of them, obviously. But I do also think you can enjoy the third one if you haven't read the first
two. Yeah, they're all standalone, Bill.
Yes.
And I think in this one, I sort of managed to get my head around it a bit more. So the thing that I might have changed in the first two, I feel like this one's a bit more,
You've got your flow down.
I've got my flow. But then you have got my nice colour scheme. And I do have
very nice.
Nothing to do with me. HarperCollins. There's a gifted designer somewhere who, has written this.
Well, they know what they're doing, but it's the inside of the book that's just as appealing as the outer.
All right, I'll take that.
Good. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode. And one last thing, Jonathan, before we go is I'm terrible at ending this podcast. I've been doing it so long and I still can't do it. How should we wrap up this conversation?
I shall say. Right. Okay, boys and girls, can you make sure you've got your coats, your lunch boxes and your book bags? And I want you to line up at the door with Mrs. Stegmans, but do not leave before we have seen that your mum or dad or whoever is here for you.
Yes, Mr. Hall.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. My mum and dad are here now, Mr. Hall. Thank you.
Okay. Walk safely. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule, wherever you get your podcasts.